The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. This is episode number 376 of the Autoblog podcast. I'm Dan Roth, and I'm joined this week by Chris Paukert and Brandon Turkus. We talk about the 2014 New York Auto Show, the Ram Runner getting some criticism on the internet, and the Ward's 10 Best Interiors list for 2014. That's all ahead on episode number 376 of the Autoblog podcast. Starts now. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog podcast. I am Dan Roth. This week, I am joined by Autoblog executive editor Chris Paukert.
Hey, how you doing?
I feel like that's the way I always introduce you. Is there something else you'd like Galactic Overlord or anything?
More like Sovereign, I think. I don't know.
Sovereign. Okay. Yeah. Autoblog Sovereign, Chris Paukert. Okay. and Brandon Turkus.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
So we have the Michigan contingent here on the podcast. So we'll start with the garage, and I don't know, Brandon, you're the new guy on the staff or on the podcast. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what you were driving this week?
This week I was testing the refreshed Camaro SS, just a base two. Well, not a base. It was the 2SS, six-speed manual, Recaro seats, dual mode exhaust. Really, if you're not going to get 1LE or Z28 or ZL1, this is kind of the one to have. It's, you know, it's got enough of the enthusiast stuff, but it's not as hardcore as those other cars.
It doesn't sound like a bad time at all, though. What's your impression?
You know, I'll be honest. I've never been much of a Camaro person. I'm firmly in the Mustang camp, but it's a good car. It sounds really nice to drive. It's plenty quick. It does handle considerably better than, you know, what I'd be used to in a Mustang. It's a more refined ride, but it's also, you know, and this is, everyone said this about the Camaro, it's a really claustrophobic. So
I was going to say it has like zero visibility.
Oh yeah. The blind spots are awful on it. It desperately needs a blind spot monitoring system,
which it does not have.
It does not have. I've got a backup camera, which is some help, but I can't figure out how to get the little guidelines on there, or if they're even our guidelines for where the tires are at. So, you know, it's not that much use.
One of the things that we do in TV production is we use tape on monitors to set up guidelines. It doesn't help when you're like turning the wheels and stuff, but at least if, you know, you want some guidelines for like those parking guidelines that they give you, you can.
Yeah. Put tape that would have been nice, but
yeah, just roll around with a roll of yellow tape. So what's it run for, I mean, cause this is like the enthusiast, dream car, right? It's the 6-speed manual V8. It's got some toys. I'm assuming it's also not cheap.
It's not cheap. And because I did not really prepare, and because it's raining outside, the Monroney, I believe, is sitting in the car, but
oh, we'll wait. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
You go get it.
No, I do have it right here. I was thinking of something else that's in there.
You were thinking of my Maroni, which I don't have.
You were thinking of the pony keg that's sitting in the passenger seat or something? Yeah.
Exactly. No, this one, it's you're right. It's not cheap. It's $42,885, and it comes with the Recaro seats, which are $2,000, but are totally, totally worth it. It's got the RS package, the dual mode exhaust, which is kind of a bargain at $900, and then the navigation system, the Chevy MyLink.
That doesn't sound that bad, actually. It's not as expensive as I'd expected. I mean, you're getting a lot of what makes us really tingle over the CTS-V for a lot less money.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's a great bargain as a car, and it's especially well balanced if you don't want, you know, all the madness that comes with the 1LE. I mean, I've driven the 1LE. I'm sure Chris can attest to it, that it's, you know, it's not the most you're looking for something that's just a little bit more better balanced, something you can use every day. That, you know, the Plain Jane SS is a great car for that.
Yeah, and does it have leather and stuff like that, or is it still cloth seats?
Well, the Recaro seats are leather and cloth or suede. And I mean, they're super supportive. They look really, really cool. They're heated, so I mean, you still retain, you know, normal functions. They're powered too, so it basically feels like a normal seat. You just have a lot more support.
So, I guess for me, the burning question now is, why not a Camaro guy? Why a Mustang guy?
It's just the way I was raised. It's, you know, you grew up in Detroit, and you know, it's a certain camp. It's, you know, you're from Boston, right?
Yeah, Boston area. Yep.
So would you root for the Yankees?
No. Well, you know, that's funny because I grew up in Connecticut. And so most of my family thought of themselves as like New Yorkers, which is funny because we're like midway between New York and Boston. So they root for the Yankees. But now that I'm in Massachusetts, it's like, no, I couldn't fathom being a Yankees fan if
yeah,
I care.
I mean, I have been raised in Michigan. I can't imagine being an Ohio State fan. It, you know, I'm from a Ford family. You know, my mom has been driving Mustang for as long as I can remember, and that's just the way I was raised. So, and I appreciate the Camaro. It's a great car. It's a lot of fun. I just rather have a Mustang.
I can respect that. I mean, I enjoy both of those cars. I mean, that in that class. You know, I love that there's enough competition that we have the Camaro and the Mustang back, because there was a period of time where there was nothing going on in the sort of pony car class. And it's,
oh, yeah.
It's been really reinvigorated.
Well, and I have to say, I really like the fact that the Chevrolet has continued to invest in the Camaro, and now this generation of Camaro can turn. And that they have, you know, higher performance models that even though you can't see out of them, they do handle, they do ride pretty well. And there's a full slate of models there for anybody from, you know, the V6 automatic crew to the full-blown Z28, you know, basically race car.
Yeah, and the Camaro looks great. You know, it's got that – I remember when these cars were sort of first coming out, right, when we were eagerly awaiting the new Camaro to arrive, and we'd see spy shots, and then we saw the first shots of it, and people, you know, thought – oh, well, you know, they didn't go as retro as the Mustang, and I think that's true, and I think it's great because of that, but they have some of those touches just in case. I mean, I still feel like the Camaro is a better-looking car than even the new Mustang, but that's all subjective, so.
I think you're going to be – have you been able to see the new Mustang in person yet?
No.
It looks better in person than it does in pictures.
That's
you know what? I actually disagree with that. I actually – fall exactly the opposite. I was a little underwhelmed in person. I think it'll look fine on the street and I'll get used to it. And I've only seen it under the auto show lights, but I'm not as convinced by that design as I was hoping to be from the photographs.
Well, see, the jury is still out. We're still going to have debate. I think they do this on purpose. So, all right, Chris, what are you driving?
Something very similar. A Camaro 1SS 1LE.
Okay.
So this is the next rung up from Brandon's car, but curiously, because mine was sort of specced like a journalist would want, mine's cheaper, $40,340 all in.
Well, and the 1SS actually starts lower. The 1SS starts at like 33.5, like 33.5, where the 2SS is a little more pricey to begin with.
Right. Yeah. The 1SS starts at $33,055. According to Mine Monroney. And the 1LE package, which includes a whole mess of stuff, is $3,500. And you can basically look at this as the halfway house between a standard SS and some of the higher end models that they have. So it includes big 20 inch wheels that are actually lighter. So I guess on a full set of 20-inch wheels, you save 22 pounds. It's got the same amount of power, but that doesn't really matter. It's got a 391 ratio. The close ratio 6-speed Tremec transmission, and a bunch of other bits stolen from the ZL1, like the great flat-bottom Alcantara wheel, and then a bunch of suspension bits, monotube rear dampers, Tolink. There's a transcooler, and the visual telltales are stuff like there's a big front splitter. And there's a matte black wrapped hood. And it's a lot of car for $40,000. It's a ton of performance. I had the unfortunate situation where the first time that I drove this car was in the pitch black driving rain on the freeway, and it is a handful.
Sounds thrilling.
Yeah, well, you know, it's got these Goodyear Eagle supercar summer tires, and we have winter ravaged roads here with some standing water in between a lot of lanes because there are potholes where, you know, the two lanes, they paved one and then they paved the other, and they've created these, you know, gutters almost where standing water lives. And the car just kept getting sucked into those, you know, side to side. Like, you just, because it's such a wide car to begin with and the tires are so wide, you know, they're 10 inch wide fronts and 11 inches in the rear. And it just tramlined and hopped all around, and it felt unnerving. You know, there's a lot of contact patch there. There's not a lot of tread to push the water out, and hydroplaning was the order of the day. So not its best for showing, but I and especially with, it's got halogen headlamps, and they kind of suck.
I was going to say, like, halogens used to be okay, and now that we've all sort of tasted from the high intensity discharge Apple, like, you get into a car with halogens and you're like, really? I can't drive this at night. I can't see.
Yeah, we've become spoiled. Yeah, these headlamps are not very good. And you're talking about a pretty powerful car and sort of an unpleasant drive situation to begin with. So that was difficult. But all was sort of forgiven after, you know, the clouds parted, and I've had a few sunnier days with it, a few warmer days, and it's a lot of fun. It makes a great noise. It sticks like crazy. And it's, you know, what Brandon was saying about not being able to see out of it is still totally correct. My car does not have a backup camera, and it's got those almond sliver mirrors. So it's really sort of a challenge to look out of. It's still the concept car that came to life, and they completely forgot to consider the driver's visibility.
All that matters in that car is what's in front of you, right?
Yeah.
Which also, forward visibility is not great.
Yeah, forward visibility is not so great in this car either. Yeah. I mean, it's great. It looks like a Hot Wheels car, you know, especially with the big 20-inch wheels and all of that. You know, they're gloss black, and you've got the black hood and some black trim. It looks really, really mean, especially in the red hot color that I had. But it's tough to see out of.
So why would you get the 1LE over the 2SS? I mean, if we're going to split Camaro hairs.
I think, you know, if you're going to be the guy that gets this car and you actually do some canyon running, or you live near some winding roads and that's the type of thing you like to do, but you can't afford the ZL1 with the magnetic ride control and all the other bits, this is a really nice way to go. I think if you're an occasional road course guy, this would help this a lot. But I don't know if it's, you know, it's certainly not something you'd want if you're the drag guy, or and if you plan on tracking it every weekend, if you can afford it, the ZL1 or, you know, the Z28 in particular would be the way to go.
Yeah, just, you know, the Z28 is double the price. So.
Correct.
Well, although,
completely,
I mean,
different animal.
Yeah, and you can buy a lot of tires for that price differential, so you can learn with this car and then trade up. So, I mean, that's always a good plan. I'm driving something completely different, not a Camaro in any form. I've got the 2014 Audi Q7 TDI. Yeah, do you remember when the Q7 came out? Like,
yeah, it was a really long time ago, back when dinosaurs and the XC90 was the only other thing that rode the earth.
Yeah, and the XC...
That was the very first automotive launch that I ever did, was on the Q7. I helped launch it when in a past life.
Yeah, I mean...
It was a long time ago.
I think the first review, or one of the first reviews I ever read on Autoblog, was of the Q7. So it's been on this earth for quite a long time. Yeah, I think the only older vehicle is the XC90 right now. And that, I mean, that's significantly older. I was actually surprised to find out that the, like, refresh my memory, the Q7 launched as a 2007 model. Yep. I thought it was older than that.
No, that was, we're still on the first generation for it, and
yeah,
I think Audi is, I'd be shocked if we didn't see something in the next year and a half on it.
You know, the funny thing is we haven't seen any prototypes running around. There, you know, there hasn't been a hint of a concept. They continue to, I think, sell reasonably well. So they just, you know, it got an update in what year, like 2009 or something, 2010. You're right. It's still not exactly a fresh vehicle. And for an Audi, to me, I expect some cleverness. And I, as far as space utilization goes, I didn't really feel it with that vehicle ever.
Yeah, it's not terribly roomy for its size. And I mean, this thing is big. It was helpful for me because when I, you know, as I was using it, I needed the cargo hauling space. But when you start to look at the amount of people space there is in it, it gets its clock cleaned now by a lot of the newer players in the space. You know, the Infiniti, what is it, the JX, is quite roomy.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a direct competitor for this. It doesn't drive as well as the Q7. That's one thing that the Q7 still has going for it, is it drives surprisingly well. Although it feels every pound of its prodigious weight. And this was the turbo diesel, too, the TDI Quattro Tiptronic. So that diesel's great. I love that diesel. 406 pound-feet of torque makes all of the mass kind of disappear. But, yeah, it feels old, though. That's one thing I noticed. I was really shocked that they still sell it, because it does feel like a time warp. And Audi's typically, like, they're on the cutting edge, right? So I don't know why they continue to sell this. It must sell well enough for them to not want to replace it, is the only thing I can come up with.
Well, according to ye old Wikipedia, in model year 2013, it sold nearly 16,000 units in the U.S. and another almost 1,800 in Canada. Well, that's not a bad total.
That's not bad for a vehicle that's old.
Yeah, for something that's that old and something that's that expensive.
Was it 16 or 60?
16.
16?
Yeah, that's not bad, dude. The previous high for that model was in 2007 when they sold 20,695 in the U.S. and 1,235. Yeah, so it actually sold the best in 2013 since 2008.
Wow, that's really surprising. I mean, I will say, like, the interior, it's got an Audi interior, which means it's beautiful. I've got the black interior with the prestige stuff and it's got Alcantara all over it and the headliner and the S-Line Plus package. And
oh, it must be spendy.
Yeah, you want to take a guess?
I don't, not with the TDI and S-Line, but go for it. Tell me what it is.
$82,000.
Oh.
$82,000?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's so German. I'm still not used to the MMI control knob, the backwards way it goes. And it just, like, you got to press a button to adjust the fan.
those are the old ergonomics from Audi. They've slowly improved those things over time, although you still get the backwards jog wheel on the MMI.
Yeah,
and they refuse to make that a setting to change it the other way, which drives me nuts.
That cabin, it is a beautiful cabin, but, you know, talking about those ergonomics, it's such an old cabin. I mean, you look at the nav screen relative to, like, a JX, like you were talking about, and it's just microscopic. Like, you can get cell phones that are bigger than that now.
I think you're right, actually.
One of those, like, phablets, like a Galaxy Note 2 or something like that. And
yeah, my son has one. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, just the overall experience in the interior, the switch here and everything, if you go from, like, a modern Audi into one of those, it all feels very, very old fashioned.
Well, you know, the switch gear and that kind of stuff, it's very good. Like, everything.
Oh, yeah. No, it's
good.
It's a good cabin. It's just an old cabin.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just an old vehicle. You know, I'd go over certain, you know, rough pavement and stuff, and I'd feel the wheels shake more, and I'd be like, huh, weird. It needs a refresh, and I'm sure they've got one coming. And I can't imagine that it's going to be this space inefficient. You know, it's going to be on one of the more modern Volkswagen Audi platforms. I think, you know, it clearly, like you guys said, you know, it's still a good seller. And with the TDI, it returns, I think I'm getting 27 and a half highway.
That's what I was getting the last time I drove. It was 26, 27.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
That's incredible for something so enormous.
Yeah.
I wish it were more accommodating of people, but, this is a vehicle I would happily click off 1,000 miles in one day. And it's great on the highway.
I wonder if the next one would be based on the new three-row Volkswagen that's going to go somewhere in North America.
That's an interesting thought.
Because that's actually a lower-cost modular platform, but it would probably suit them just as well.
But do you think they'd be able to price it up enough, or is it going to be, because you have the Q5 down at that lower price point, and if they
I don't know that it necessarily has to be any less sophisticated. My guess is it's going to be, just by the dint of the fact that it's more modern, it'll probably be structurally stiffer. It'll probably be made out of more high-strength steel and ultra-high-strength steel. So why couldn't it be?
Yeah, well, and I think that's the thing that they've got to combat, too. Like, this is a vehicle that probably isn't as high-strength steel intensive as a newer model would be. So, and it weighs in at, like, 5,600 pounds, which is rather considerable.
That is.
And it does definitely feel like it. It feels heavy. As surprisingly well as it handles, it also feels heavy. And it's got the air suspension and stuff. And it just – one thing I was never able to really – get sort of to my satisfaction was a comfortable ride over certain expansion joints and stuff. It just, again, it felt like something that's got wheels and tires that are too big for it, too low profile, something that would have been better a few years ago when we weren't as giant wheel crazy as we are now.
Well, and I think over time automakers have figured out how to tune for those massive wheels, and frankly the tires have gotten better themselves. So you can have a 20-inch wheel and still have a really compliant ride now, where even a few years ago that would have been harder to do and still have a decent handling vehicle.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know what? If they can sell, a 7-year-old car for $82,000, there's nothing wrong with what they're doing.
Sell more of them in 2013 than they have at any time since 2008.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder how many of these things are leased. And I wonder, what is the lease payment on a Q7 that's $82,000? Like, that's a lot of money. That's probably more than your apartment, guys. Like, that's a lot.
More than my apartment.
Well, I mean, you don't have an apartment, unless there's something we don't know about you. But
it's probably more than my apartment.
Yeah. I'm still boggled. Like, how – because it's so – like, ostensibly, it's a family vehicle, right? But who – I don't know. 82 grand. If you're going to spend 82 grand, get a Mercedes, get a GL.
And people do.
Grand, I'm getting a Range Rover at that point.
Yeah. Well,
but you're going to get a base Range Rover, and he's got a loaded diesel. There's definitely a lot more capacious, newer things on the market. I mean, I've got a GMC Yukon in my driveway right now, the XL, and I think it's 67 grand. Now, granted, it's not a Denali, and GMC, as nice as it is, doesn't have the badge cachet of Audi, but it's another way to go that certainly has a lot more space in it and ultimately probably has significantly more capability.
Yeah, but I, it's a nice ride for a week, and I'd be happy to drive out to Michigan in the summer with this. I was really impressed with how well it just eats up the miles, which is, and when you're considering a family vehicle, I think that's really important. Is you got to consider, like, how long am I going to sit with this before my legs go numb and I just I want to get out of it. And it's it's still impressively an Audi, even though it's rather ancient. But anyway, we're going to see some new cars coming up soon at the New York Auto Show, which is this week. And what is it? Gets underway, what, tomorrow? Tuesday?
Wednesday.
That's right. So we've gotten some trickles of information out. I'm looking at what I've seen so far. It looks like to be the sedatest of auto shows so far with what we've seen. Is that something accurate, or do I have surprises in store?
I mean, I think there'll be some surprises. I actually feel like this show is more robust for New York. It's been shaping up that way with more important products, even if some of them are just, you know, mid-cycle refreshes of the Camry or a new Sonata or a new Kia Sedona, something like that. But there's a lot of real-world product in here, and there's a lot of crossovers, which I learned something interesting from the Jeep folks this week. And I don't have any source to attribute it to other than them, but they say that New York State is the biggest SUV market in the country, which I find really interesting and surprising.
Huh.
And furthermore, it's the biggest Jeep market in the country.
Oh, well, I feel offended by that, given the fact that they told us that New England is their biggest market. But, well, I mean, you know, it is the Northeast. They say the Northeast, and they include New York and Northeast. So,
yeah.
All right. I'll share. But I guess that's what I mean when I say, like, it's the most sedate show. It's not that it's not going to have a lot of stuff and a lot of really interesting good stuff. It's just, you know, when there's a car show like Detroit or Geneva, which just, you know, went by, both of those went by not too long ago. The big buzz is usually around something like really special, right? The Corvette, the latest like McLaren supercar, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, some new Veyron, something like that. In New York, we have what I've seen so far, a restyled Versa, a restyled Cruze, a restyled Murano.
New Murano.
Okay. So it's new? It's not just restyled?
It's new. It's full boat new. It's on a diet. It lost 120 pounds. It's still bigger on the outside, bigger on the inside. The only thing that really seems to be carryover is the powertrain. So it still has the 3.5 liter V6 with the same horsepower as last year, and the Xtronic CVT, which has probably been, you know, tweaked again.
You could do worse than that. Okay, so we've got, and the biggest news so far for me is the new diesel VW wagon and the most lightly retouched Jetta ever. I think the biggest thing of the show overall is the Kia Sedona. So, minivan.
You keep saying, like, you're saying, like, oh, the biggest thing. And I'm hearing, I'm waiting for you to say the words Corvette Z06 convertible.
Oh, yeah, but we've seen the Corvette.
And I'm not hearing it.
Well, but we've seen the Corvette. Like, so that's
It's the first Z06 convertible.
Okay. All right. That is impressive. And
not the first. They did one in, like, 1960, and they sold literally one of them. But
all right, so that'll get you excited. A Z06 convertible, that'll tear the toupee right
up. There are going to be some exciting cars at this show, and I agree it's much more down to earth show. But you know, it's not all Versas and Jettas and Chevy Cruze.
No, I mean there's a new XB too.
The version, whatever it is, 32. No, there's a lot of stuff that we haven't seen yet that we're expecting, and in fact has been confirmed. We know that there's the Acura TLX production model. We know that there's going to be an S63 AMG. It's the U.S. debut for the Jeep Renegade. So there's a bunch of stuff. We're going to get the refreshed Challenger and Charger.
Yeah, which I think we'll be surprised when we see those show up. The Renegade, I want to see that in person because, you know, they're doing the same thing that they did last year, right? They had the Cherokee last year, and it came out just ahead of its debut in pictures, and everybody was, like, aghast.
Well, right, but it also came out like some horrible base version in a factory blurry photograph.
That's right.
On a cell phone. At least we have the correct view of the Renegade now.
Yeah, so I think what's the top so far that you know about? I mean, the Corvette seems like it's your thing, Brandon. The S63 AMG doesn't suck, never does. Is there something that you've already sort of like that's going to be something you make it a point to go find at the show? Well, I mean, we're there.
Yeah, I'm actually not going to the show, unfortunately, because I'm going to Beijing at the end of the week. For that show. The Discovery Vision concept from Land Rover looks like it's going to be pretty cool. There's going to be something related to the Miata, and anything Miata related attracts me like a moth to a flame. I don't believe it's going to be the complete car. I don't know if they're going to show a sketch. I have a feeling they'll probably do something like show the body in white or something.
Well, that'll be cool enough. I mean, you'll get a lot of idea of what the next Miata is going to look like if you see that body in white and a lot of the upgrades and changes. Because, I mean, that's, speaking of old cars on the market, when was the last time the Miata was redone?
2004, 2005. 2005, yeah. I think.
Something like that. It's been around quite a while, and it's still a fun car, but it's not.
Oh, but it's definitely dated now.
Yeah. So I less honestly,
for its driving dynamics, more for its interior and tech and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but you can forgive it in that car because if you're playing with the tech, you're not driving. And
yeah, it's not the right car anyway.
Yeah, I'm honestly very impressed with the Sedona. I think that's the biggest news we've seen so far, and like, I honestly wonder if that's going to reinvigorate in some way the minivan market, which has sort of been plodding along. It does okay. And it seems like pretty much everybody has ceded minivans to Toyota and Honda. And, you know, Chrysler, if you want a good value that has no resale. but, you know, Kia has sort of been like this in and out player with the minivans and the latest Sedona. Like, if they've learned, the last time I drove a Sedona, it felt like it had worn out shocks and stuff like that. And that's been the common criticism of Kia and Hyundai, is they couldn't figure out how to tune suspensions.
Well, and the even though they've brought that model back after, I think, a 1 year hiatus or so, the current Sedona is—it's really a, you know, an old Kia in the sense that it's a commodity car. It's something you buy because it's affordable. It got good safety ratings, and it wasn't, you know, for the money, it was a decent value, but it wasn't ever something that was going to contend for the, you know, best driving or most sophisticated vehicle in the class, like something like an Odyssey might.
Yeah, and I mean, there's something to be said too for not—you know—you don't always have to stretch to be the top of the class. You just have to be competent, right? Like, that's,
well, especially if you've got a price advantage and yeah, a, you know, warranty advantage.
Yeah, but and this one looks like it's funny because they snagged Peter Schreier, and so this is a Peter Schreier helmed design, and you can see it in the just the way it looks and how it lines up with all of the other Kia and Hyundai, or well, Kia for the most part lineup. You know, it's got that nice clean premium look that doesn't sell for premium money, which is I think one of the ways that Kia is having some success. It almost looks like an Audi minivan would look to me. So I was really impressed to see it, and the interior looks like it's, you know, they've figured out how to make it at least look premium. I'm not sure how it feels. You know, I'm surprised that I'm that excited about a minivan, but maybe I lead a very boring life.
That's a sign that you're getting old.
Yeah, I'll deal with it. I mean, minivans are great, though, if they are well
done. Minivans are amazing. They yeah, really are.
Yeah, Brandon's sitting there, like, shaking his head like, you guys are nuts.
No, I appreciate
a good minivan. I have a lot of appreciation for minivans. I enjoy them.
Really? I'm surprised, because, like, you're a younger single guy, so, I mean...
No, I think, you know, it's never something I would want to buy. And, you know, my girlfriend has said flat out that in the future she will never drive a minivan. But there's something that you can appreciate because they're just so good at one singular purpose. And that's something that I've always liked about them. Like, if you want to get a bunch of people somewhere comfortably, there's no better vehicle out there than a minivan.
Or stuff. Or stuff, yeah.
It's just a really good hauler.
Yeah, and so that's, I mean, it seemed to me like for the longest time, that stuff was all locked up by the Odyssey. It's like, oh, minivan, Odyssey. Oh, I don't like the Odyssey. Okay, go get the Sienna. They're like two different flavors of the same kind of thing.
That's pretty much the way it's been, especially if you're, you know, from an affluent area or someplace that doesn't have domestic loyalties.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, if you want to save some money, you go and get the caravan or the Town and Country. But it's, you, Chris, you mentioned you're going to Beijing. That there's another sort of interesting thing we're going to see over there, the Lexus NX, which is that the vehicle I think that Lexus is banking on as much as it looks like they might be banking on it.
Oh, I think they are. I mean, that's one of the fastest growing segments. Lexus knows how to sell crossovers. The RX has been its bread and butter for a really long time. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. It's sort of shocking that they haven't come up with another crossover to this point, because they've had so much success with the RX. So to me, it's amazing that it took this long to get a smaller model and also a three-row version, frankly.
Yeah, and so I guess let's back up to the NX. It's a smaller Lexus crossover. It's actually going to be – it's significant too, because it's going to be the first turbocharged Lexus. They just came out with a bunch of new – or a couple of new engines. The NX is going to get one of those engines, a small turbo, which is significant.
Yeah, I mean, a two-liter, which is going to go into a lot of stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. So it should get decent fuel economy, at least if you manage to stay out of the turbo. There will be a hybrid version. So I think this is going to sell a lot of vehicles. If people get comfortable with the styling, which is anything but boring, I'm not in love with it. I mean, it's definitely more toned down than some of the concept versions they've been threatening to release on roads. but I would not call it a pretty vehicle, but it is rather intimidating, and rather masculine to me. And you don't see a whole lot of these smaller crossovers that are masculine generally.
Well, and the small luxury crossovers too. I mean, that's burgeoning, right? That's the X1. That's I want to think of the
GLA.
GLA. Yeah. I was going to say GLK, but that's.
I think it's going to be a little bigger than that too, though.
So
I mean, I know that the RX isn't that much bigger, and they're both two rows, but I suspect that the next RX will grow. And that this won't be as small as something like an X1, which is really quite tiny.
Yeah, the X1 is sort of like the – well, it's funny you described this like an old BMW, because it's just made up from pieces. Right. And it does – like the X1 doesn't really do anything for me, because it just looks too funky, which is weird in a BMW these days, because they're generally – you know, they got a lot more restrained and a little more classical in the way they looked after the Bangle stuff. You know, this latest generation of BMWs is a lot more safe. The X1 is still kind of wonky. And this, the NX, I see a lot of Lexus IS in it. And that is, I guess that's a compliment, but I mean, love or hate the IS, I guess it's where Lexus is going. What do you think of how the NX looks? Okay. Well.
Brandon loves it.
Clearly.
No, I don't love it even a little bit. And I kind of went on a tirade in our little group chat earlier this week when we first saw it. And, I think I got a lot of problems with the design. And I the thing is, I like the design of the IS, but I think they missed the mark on the NX. And let me find it, because I need to see it to properly channel my anger.
Well, what don't you like about it? So, I mean, specifically, is it that like a sort of insect-like spindle grill? I'll give you that. That's terrible.
And it's sort of hard to get around that. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you don't like that grill, that pretty much defines the entire vehicle, and you're sort of stuck at that point. Then.
Yeah, I'm. I think it's underwheeled for one. I think the choice to go with 17s as standard and 18s as optional is, you know, it's going to be a more comfortable ride. I get that. But you look at the pictures and you just think, if those wheels were like an inch or two larger and it just kind of fill out those wheel wells. And the belt line and the roof line, the way they interact, it's not aggressive enough to like look really cool, but it's also not, you know, wide enough to have a really expansive greenhouse.
Yeah, I will say this looks like a visibility nightmare.
Yeah, it's you know, it tries to do like the aggressive, the Range Rover Evoque thing with the, you know, the chop top and stuff like that, but it doesn't quite go far enough. But at the same time, it still compromises visibility in the first place.
Yeah, and that's the trend. Like, everybody's doing that kind of thing. So I can't.
But if you're gonna do it, go all the way.
I see. So like,
you know, don't half-ass it, because that's, you know, that. I look at the belt line, and I look at the roof line, and that's what I see, is just like, we really like that, the way that looks, but we didn't want to go that far. We're going to go that far on the rest of the car, but not on that particular area.
So who does this sell to anyway? Like, because the RX, we know who the RX sells to. So who does the NX going after?
I think it's the people that, you know, they don't want an IS because they don't want a sedan. And that's, I think those are going to be, and obviously I don't know what the pricing is going to look like on it. So, but I think this is going to appeal to IS shoppers that are looking for something that's, you know, a little bit different. That's maybe not as roomy, but a little bit, you know, more rugged, I guess. I don't know. Chris, what do you think?
I think it's going to appeal to people that either don't have kids, or maybe they've got one, you know, one baby, you know, one toddler, or on the other end, empty nesters, if they can get their arms around the way it looks, which I think is more of a tough sell.
Or kids without legs. If they have kids without legs.
No, it'll still have a back seat. I mean, I just looked it up and it's 182.7 inches long. An X1 is 176.5. A GLK Mercedes is 178.3. So it's actually almost the size of an RX, which is 187.8. You know, it's a half a foot shorter.
Yeah.
So if you've got a more upright roof line, you could actually fit real people in the back of this thing.
Well, that's not terrible. I mean, that's...
I had no idea it was quite that big. I thought it...
Yeah, no, I knew it was going to be bigger than... Like for instance, the really small version of this things in this class would be probably an Evoque, and that's 171.9. So this is significantly larger than that.
Okay.
So am I the only one, by the way, who doesn't like the way the Evoque drives? I mean, I think, like, if this drives like a Lexus, it's gonna have striking looks, at least for a while, until everybody gets used to it, and it'll drive sort of I don't want to say mundane, but it'll drive friendly enough where the Evoque sort of I was put off by the Evoque. I can't be the only person in the world who's not thrilled with the way that drives. So
it's been a long time since I drove it, so I can't really.
I like the Evoque, but it definitely demands something of the driver. So there's a lot of head toss. You know, it's pretty stiffly sprung. And remember, also, again, it's short, so it has a shorter wheelbase and all of that. So that takes its toll on ride, and the power delivery maybe isn't as friendly as something like you would expect on a Lexus. But yeah. I still like the vehicle. I think it looks sensational. I think the interior is great. It is hard to swallow spending that much money on something so small, but seems to be working out for him.
Well, you lease it. Everybody leases these things. I guess that's my refrain now. It's just like, oh, well, nobody buys them. They lease them. So the dealers buy them.
Hey, that's the game, though. I mean, if everybody's doing that, it's still a sale.
Yeah, well, and then it has a second life as a, you know, a CPO car, which I think is a really big deal for these luxury brands. The whole CPO programs, it's the way people get, you know, a 2 or 3 year old car, really nice condition, more car than they'd buy new. And you know, who's going to say that it's not new if it's kept well enough? So,
mm-hmm.
So all right. So the New York show is happening like right on top of Beijing. There's a couple of really exciting, interesting things. And then there's a lot of sort of, well, I guess it's good that we're seeing the refreshes, right? I was going to say there's a lot of refreshes to sort of fill in, but that's good. That means that there's enough heat in the market to generate the need to refresh these things instead of just continuing to sell them as they were. Or maybe the refreshes are to try to generate demand. I don't know. Is it a push or a pull? It remains to be seen. The car market.
Well, the things that are getting refreshes are volume products. The Camry, you know, despite our lukewarm praise for it at best, still sells better than anything else. The Cruze has been a solid seller from day one. The Versa sedan, unfortunate looking though it may be, is the number one seller in its segment. So it's not a question of drumming up more sales. It's a question of pushing more momentum. Same thing with the Focus sedan. Number one nameplate in the world.
Yeah, I wonder about the, you know, the sort of the Versa, how everybody, all the auto writers, we love to take shots at that, but it sells well enough. It's almost one of those cars. It's like, oh, clearly we don't get it.
Well, and I'll tell you why that car sells. It sells well because it's huge inside. It's one of America's cheapest cars. It's reliable. It's quiet. It gets good fuel economy. And if that's all you need is, you know, space and reliability and decent fuel economy, it's a perfectly fine car for you. It's you know, very simple to operate. You know, the controls are all very intuitive. It's just, it's not particularly good to drive. I think it's certainly not attractive. I think they're much more dynamic vehicles in the class, but frankly, there are a lot of people that don't really care about that.
Yeah, like most people, I would say, don't care about that. Yeah. And that's fine. That's not a criticism. That's just
reality.
Yeah. I do think that the Camry, like every time there's a new Camry or a refreshed Camry, that is big news. So we just saw the Camry get refreshed not too long ago, though. So how deep is this going to be is my question. I realize that remains to be seen. But my guess is that it's more of like a front nip and a rear tuck and some interior changes. And that's
I think it is, but they've been making noises that it'll be a little bit more than just the standard Toyota, you know, slight rearranging of light clusters and fascia. I think they realize they need to do a little bit more work, and they've been talking at least, you know, in hushed tones about needing a more emotional design. I actually don't think it's going to be that dynamic visually, but I do think it'll be a clear departure.
Yeah, so I'm going to make a prediction and say that that's one of our highest traffic posts with the most comments when that one goes live.
You're really going out on a limb there, man.
Yeah, I know. The Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. All right. Well, so that's the New York show. We'll keep an eye on it. Let's move on to another topic. The Ram Runner, and Brandon, you wrote this post. It seems like the Ram Runner has run into a little criticism from professional racers, or at least one professional racer in particular.
Frankly, I don't know that much about this guy, but I think this is what he's saying is the point of view that from someone that only really understands his particular segment of the business, and he doesn't really know what he's talking about in regards to, you know, the actual process of building and selling cars. Yeah. I think he's kind of the typical guy, like, you know, that says, well, why don't they do this and this and this and this and this, you know, which, you know, we get people that comment on stories all the time that say something similar, and they end up thinking about a car that only appeals to a very select, very hardcore group of people. And I don't think that was what Chrysler had in mind when they asked for his input on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess basically the gist of it is that the Ram Runner is a joke, and I want to,
I don't think the Ram Runner is a joke at all. I think that's completely wrong way of looking at it. It's that it's a very, and what this guy thought it was going to be, he thought he was going to be building a genuine Raptor competitor that came from the factory and was built at the factory. He didn't think that he was going to be building what is it? Basically,
it's an
aftermarket parts kit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's an aftermarket parts kit that when pickuptrucks.com tested it against the Raptor, it actually, you know, I mean, tests are tests, right? So take it with a grain of salt, but it beat it had a faster lap time around this terrain loop than the Raptor. So it's not like it does nothing.
No. But I mean, also consider how much more it costs. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think this guy is just, you know, complaining that Ram really should offer a factory package that's competitively priced against the Raptor, as opposed to this, you know, maybe more hardcore, race-minded individual that has a bunch of cash to throw into this and maybe wants to personalize it a little bit along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's okay. One of the things that was said was that, you know, Chrysler was asking about how they could get away with, you know, can we get away with a moderate shock upgrade and some stickers? And I can see how that would be really offensive to you if these are the tools of your trade, right? If this is, you know, no, you can't do that. I'm not going to go run Baja with stickers. but on the other hand, like when you're building something to sell, you know, the Raptor, how many Raptors do you see actually sort of doing what they're supposed to be doing?
The same number of Range Rovers that I see off road. I mean, they just, I'm sure.
Oh, I disagree with that. I think there's a lot of people that actually use this vehicle, the Raptor. There are, I don't think it's as hardcore as maybe like a Jeep audience, but certainly more than anything from Land Rover. Those guys are out there using them. They're modding them. They're trail running. They're running on sand dunes, all that sort of stuff. I mean, they have clubs that they go around with and do some pretty intense stuff. I mean, I think that's part of what got the Raptor dinged a little bit early is they had enthusiasts that were running out there beyond the capability of the vehicles and bending the frames.
Yeah, and I remember when that was a big to-do, and Ford basically came back and said, yeah, we made it bend so you didn't die.
Because exactly right.
If it didn't bend, then you'd wind up, you know, 10 feet in the air and then on your roof. So, so the criticism is coming from Kent Croker. I think I said, you know, got his name right. He's a Baja racer, and he actually helped develop the Ram Runner. So, I mean, it sounds like there's a difference of opinion on what was going to fly and what they could sell and what he wanted to do. And there's always that disappointment when you're developing a product and there's a corporate entity involved and there's a group of people versus one person. So, I mean, it feels like a bit of sour grapes to me to start, you know, talking smack at this point in the game.
Yeah, I think that's the reason why this is a story is because it is somebody that was associated with the development of the vehicle, and it's just so unusual to see people taking to a public forum and talking smack like that and comparing it directly to a competitor.
Yeah, I mean, he has some nice phrases, though, you know, like, you know, Chrysler would rather spend their government money jargoneering. I like that, jargoneering. That's good.
That's the new model, the jargoneer.
Yeah. you know, I guess you could say that, you know, Chrysler should build a legit competitor, you know, production competitor to the Raptor. But
at the time, you got to think about, you know, this was 2011 when the Ram Runner was announced. They were probably developing it in, you know, 2010. You know, Chrysler was not exactly in good shape back then. They had a lot of bigger holes in their lineup that they need to fill, and they need to replace with solid, reliable product. And they didn't necessarily need to go out and build a challenger to a niche product from a competitor.
I agree with that, and I think at the time too that they were developing this vehicle, nobody, including Ford, could have reasonably expected the strong sales response of the Raptor. And then when the Raptor came out and it got such great write-ups and it started selling in really significant volumes, everybody was taken a little bit aback, and this was pretty much all they could put out the front door. And it's, you know, this wasn't cheap. I mean, I think the stage two package for the Ram Runner by itself was like 13 grand, and you needed another 15 grand worth of stuff before, you know, the cost associated with assembling it all. So it really came off as sort of a different type of vehicle and certainly a different cost than a Raptor.
Yeah, and you know, also think about the longevity of this model, right? Like, do you really think that we're going to see three generations of Raptor?
I hope so.
Yes, I do actually.
I
100% do, because it's selling in such significant volumes, and it's a halo truck for them. And it's basically the first super truck of its sort, and it's something that everybody can afford. It's still picking up steam, and it's starting to do business globally. And I think that they're tapping other markets. I mean, there are people that want that thing in China, and they're spending extra money. And you know, obviously, there's huge taxation issues. There are people in the Middle East that want it. I don't think it's a one and done model by any stretch of the imagination. I think you'll be seeing the Raptor around for quite a while.
I'm surprised by that. I mean, I think that you get to a certain like critical mass of people who want them, get them, and then where do you go from there? I guess going global drives more demand, so that's not stupid. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this isn't like another SVT thing like the Lightning, which was pretty much a one-trick pony. You had to really want that type of vehicle. You know, it had maybe a 500-pound payload or something like that. The Raptor really doesn't demand many concessions of the owner versus a standard F-150. It really drives pretty well on the pavement. The fuel economy is not that much better or worse than any other F-150 model.
Yeah.
So you're really not asking too much. It's not catastrophically expensive compared to other things in the F-150 lineup. So I don't see why it wouldn't continue to sell in future generations.
Well, I guess we'll see. I mean, I'm trying to picture what a Raptor, you know, looks like. You know, where do you go from here? Do you just continue to get, you know, do the same kind of treatment to the whatever the current truck is? Or, you know, how do you evolve?
Why not? I mean, look at how much better it should be when it drops 700 pounds because it's aluminum. I mean, yeah, think of what that does for you.
It'll fly better.
It'll fly better. It should land better. It should do all sorts of things better.
Yeah, I mean, you know, more power to them if they can sell them and keep that niche going. You know, I guess it's kind of from where I sit, it's going to be like the Vans in the 70s. You know, all of a sudden the nation's going to come to its senses and go, you know, I think it's time for a nice Civic.
Oh, no, I hope not.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, crazier things have happened. So I'm just shocked that there's that much sort of complaining about something that is just an, I mean, it's an awesome aftermarket package, you know, and props for putting it out there. Nobody, you're never going to please everybody. So,
hey, we don't know the backstory on this. I mean, this, this guy might've, gotten the shaft and not gotten a next generation Ram Runner contract and been disgruntled. Who knows?
Yeah. And I know all about being disgruntled.
It's your stock and trade, man.
Yeah, he sounds some kind of disgruntled. All right. Well, you know, we'll keep an eye out for the next Raptor, and we'll see if there's a Ram that kind of does. Because they have, like, now they're coming out with all kinds of special edition Rams, right? Every now and then you'll see, like, the, you know, the Orvis edition or something.
The moderate shock and sticker packages?
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe there's a future for it now that Chrysler's on a better footing and the Ram is really doing well sales-wise. It just depends on how long they, you know, they continue to do well sales-wise and how they're getting there. So,
well, the pickup truck segment, probably more than any other segment, is really, you know, it's really smash mouth. And there's a lot of crosstalk and smack talk going across here in Detroit. And I would be a little bit surprised if, you know, the continued strong results of the Raptor don't result in other products from other automakers. I'll just say that.
I mean, we haven't really seen a GM competitor to these, and that would be something interesting to see.
Sure.
Especially since those trucks could use a boost. So we'll keep an eye on that. In the meantime, one of the things that comes out this time of year is there's always lots of awards. You know, it starts in January and it continues to just sort of keep trickling. We just had the Ward's 10 Best Interiors for 2014. And I think who better to talk about this than those of us that spend a week a year in a different, like every week of the year in a different interior. That is us. That is the car writers. So they've come out with their best interiors for 2014, includes some gems like the Corvette, which is surprising because for years it's been called one of the worst interiors. New Corvette, new interior. That'll be good for at least a couple of years. The Chrysler 200, they like that. The GMC Sierra Denali, they like that. A couple of surprises too, like the Hyundai Equus Ultimate. That's a head scratcher. The Mazda 3, like some of these things on this list don't strike me as like the real standouts. Maybe it's you know, their rules are to be considered, it must offer newer, significantly designed interior, significantly redesigned interior. There's no price cap. So, I mean, what do you guys think of the list? Have you had a chance to peruse it? And
I actually wrote the story on this one. And, you know, the ones that really surprised me, I think the Mazda 3, the redesigned Mazda 3 absolutely deserves to be on the list. It's, you know, for its price point, I think it's a really impressive interior. The Soul, I was kind of surprised by. The Sierra Denali I was surprised by, and the Cherokee. And those were my three surprises.
Interesting.
I was shocked that the Equus is on there, and I haven't been in the latest like Equus Ultimate, but the last Equus I was in, it gets certainly nice, but it's just like, you know, it felt about the same as the interior in the Optima. You know, it's just like a bigger Optima interior, which is not, it's not bad, but it's, you know, it's a $70,000 supposed luxury sedan, right? So I was like, you know, not exactly wowed by that interior. I wasn't offended by it either, but to see it on the list, have they done some changes to make it, you know, stand out more?
There have been some upgraded materials like low gloss woods, and I believe they've updated the sat nav and some bits and pieces. But your thinking is really similar to mine, Dan. The only vehicle that I was unhappy with on this list was the Equus. I don't get that at all. I mean, they did put in a digital gauge cluster, but I still see some of the same switchgear that I remember from our long-term car, which was, you know, not that exciting, not that robust. I don't know. I mean, I haven't spent a prolonged amount of time in the updated vehicle, but I was really surprised to see it on the list. I think everything else on the list, to me, is a really worthy choice, though.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the Equus does that Hyundai Kia thing, right? So it has, you know, for its money, it's short money, and you get reclining seats with massage and stuff, a big, big back seat, you know, so it's really that sort of overseas executive car.
Well, and that's the funny thing is the back seat's actually, to me, not big enough. Because they offer, if you go into the ultimate package, they offer the passenger side model with the ottoman that pops out, you know, sort of S-class like or Maybachian.
Yeah. Maybach.
But it's not. Yeah. See what I did there? But I it doesn't give enough room. I mean, it's designed for, I guess, Korean-sized executives. I don't know what
short
else to
people.
Say. Yeah, maybe that's why it feels big to you, Dan, because it's really not. You end up right in the back with your shoes right in the back of the front seat, even when it's pushed forward all the way.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, I didn't think it was also like that's the thing again. Like they call it cavernous. I'm like, yeah, well, it's a big car, but it's not you know, Gigantor size. It's not like the LS460L that is just humongous in the rear cabin. So the Mazda 3, I was surprised because I thought that was a nice interior, nicely done, but you know, it's in a class that's really competitive and it's surrounded by a lot of other nice stuff. So
I think what they liked, you know, with that vehicle too, is that there's a new infotainment system that's got that all-in-one controller and the touchscreen. And I remember hearing you recently say that you didn't really care for that. I think it's actually a very well-designed system, pretty minimalist with very few choices that you know, it's easy to figure out.
You know, I think what I didn't like about it was it's different. It takes some getting used to. I think if it were a car that I were to buy, I would get used to it eventually, and I wouldn't necessarily have that much to criticize about it. It takes, you know, normally you reach for a radio knob, right? So the knob is now on the console, which is funny because the Q7 is exactly the same way. It's got the volume knob for the audio system console. So you can, when you think about it, like, think of your posture in the car. It seems like they actually thought about this. They looked at the way people drive. You know, you got one elbow on the armrest and you're just sort of cruising along and you want to play with the audio system or the controls. The stuff is right at hand down on the console versus, like, a stretch to the center stack
or on the wheel.
Yeah. So it seems like, you know, there was some thought that went into that. Their little controller and stuff, it just felt like they were, you know, taking notes from the high end Europeans and applying those to a much more attainable car. So kudos for that. You can't have everything though. So some of the slick integration that the European systems like, iDrive, which I find crazy that I'm praising it now that we all hated it so much for so many years. But it's, you know, it's not quite there, but it's not bad. You know, it's definitely a step up from the Mazda 3 before with that teeny tiny little screen that was like 3 feet away that you could hardly read. So it's better than that. But Brandon, I want to know why were you so surprised to see your surprises on here?
In the Sierra Denali, I understand why it's on there, and that's because of the pickup trucks, I think it's the only one that new or significantly updated. The Ram has been out for a year or two now. The F-150 is older than dirt. So I kind of feel like if they were looking for a pickup truck, it was kind of like, well, this is all that's left. I wasn't that impressed by it. I have not driven the Denali. I drove the High Country, which is the equivalent Chevy, I guess. Yeah. And, you know, nothing in there really blew me away. It was a fine interior, but I'm pretty sure you could get a nicer interior from Dearborn or Auburn Hills.
I don't know. I do not find anything all that opulent in the F-Series trucks.
I definitely don't think you can get something from Dearborn that's nicer right now. Maybe when the new one comes out. And there are some really nice high-end Rams. But I think, you know, it's a well-laid-out interior. And I think the other thing that maybe you don't see in the touch points and, you know, the switchgear feel and all that is it's dead quiet. It is significantly quieter than anything else.
That is true.
I don't know if they factor that in, but it's really impressive in that regard. Probably more than any other singular aspect of that new truck for me.
Yeah, it is very. It's a very quiet, sort of smooth interior. And when you go down the road, you're like, is it on? Is it running? I did like that about the GM trucks. It's just, you know, the Ram has. Like you say, there's some very nice Rams. Ram has had a nice interior for a long time.
Those Laramie Limiteds and
oh yeah, but up is the operative word. I mean, that's $50,000-$60,000.
Well, the Denali is $50,000-$60,000. Yeah, you know, it's almost 57 on here. So you know, you're looking at the competitor to the Denali, and I think you know if you put these two side by side, I feel like the Ram would squeak away.
I guess it's just the Ram isn't significantly new this year, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the problem. Like that's, you know, I'm assuming they were looking for a pickup truck and the choices were the Toyota Tundra and the Denali or the GM twins. So,
you know, I drove a Tundra Platinum. I thought that had a nice interior too.
It's a nice interior. It's not as good as the High Country / yeah, Denali.
I was going to say it's certainly a huge leap from where the Tundra started with generation, but it's funnily enough, I found it more comfortable than the GM trucks. It's certainly not as nicely done in terms of materials and fit and finish and those things, but just a general level of comfort, I was much more comfortable in the Tundra Platinum than I was in the even the high spec GM trucks. So that was surprising to me. Yeah.
I haven't spent any time in the refreshed Tundra, so I can't speak to that myself.
Yeah, maybe it was just the luck of the draw that week where there's certain weather events or something going on where it's just nice. I don't know. What I'm not surprised to see on the list, the 2014 Rolls-Royce Wraith. And Chris, you just drove this.
I did, and I'm not at all surprised to see it on there. I mean, it is a beautiful car. I had driven a Phantom years ago, like when it first came out briefly, but I hadn't spent a quality amount of time in a modern Rolls-Royce. And I mean, I have to tell you, it is a special place from stem to stern inside.
It better be. It costs $400,000.
Yeah, but I mean, it actually, you know, kind of oddly and absurdly, it sort of feels like it. I mean, from the moment you open the doors, I mean, obviously it's got the reverse hinged suicide doors, which is its own sort of grandeur. But then you open it and you see this massive, and I mean massive, wood veneer on the door. It's like a ship. There's no other vehicle that I can think of that has so much wood on one door, and just beautifully done. You know, you open it and there's the umbrellas, of course, that are mounted in the fenders, and there's the Starliner headliner, which you can, you know, choose to spend thousands of dollars to get or not. People were split on that in my time with the car. Some people thought it was amazing, and my girlfriend likened it to Mariah Carey throwing up on the ceiling. So there's two ways to look at it. I actually thought it was, you know, it's over the top, certainly, but I think it's kind of fitting. And it just, you know, the attention to detail, the feel of the switchgear, the fact that, you know, when you get into these hyper expensive cars, whether it's a supercar like a Lamborghini or it's something like a Bentley, very often they have last generation tech inside. And, you know, you think, well, why am I spending $300,000 to get a satellite navigation system that's inferior to what's in a, you know, $25,000 Jetta? But you don't have that problem here. This has the latest generation of iDrive, but it's skinned to look unique, and everything just feels right. It's an amazing car.
Of course it is. I mean, it's again, it's a Rolls Royce, and
well,
even
you can say of course it is, but it's not always that way. I mean, I've been in Lamborghinis that are, you know, fantastic, fun to drive, but they feel terrible inside, and they look cobbled together. So I don't think that just because there's a huge price tag and a brand name associated with it, that you can assume that it's going to be a great vehicle. This one is. I mean, it drove beautifully and all of that. I was kind of shocked at how much I enjoyed that vehicle overall, but I found the interior to be really something special.
Well, you know, that's one of the real differentiators, you know, I would expect in a Rolls-Royce. If you're going to spend that kind of money, if you're going to have that sort of bespoke luxury, because it's funny, like here in the U.S., they sort of pre-order the cars because that's the way we do things. But in other parts of the world, every Rolls is a custom order.
Sure.
You know, and you wait for it. And we don't like to wait. So they're very good at picking cars that will you know, connect with our tastes and, you know, sell off of out of inventory. But that's really like you don't want to have that kind of special car and then see even the nicest BMW stuff in there. You know, that to me, that would be really off-putting. You know, so it's got to have that level of just really, really special and really handcrafted, really high-end workmanship.
Sure, and I think you know, I've driven the Mulsanne, for instance, and that's more expensive than this vehicle, and it definitely has the incredible hand-tooled leather. You know, the stitching in one of, you know, 32 different ways, however you want it. It didn't feel as special as this.
Yeah, and I can see that. You know, it's funny that the Bentleys seem to be almost like those are the driver's bespoke luxury car, right?
Yeah.
Versus the Rolls is more the
being driven.
Yeah, but I mean, the Wraith isn't really about being driven, though, is it?
No, well, I mean, it's a two-door, and it actually drives very well. I mean, it definitely has a light sense for the steering, and it's got a thin-rimmed wheel and all that. So it's you don't really feel like you want to hurry along in it, but it's capable of doing that.
Yeah. Well, not to let's not belabor the point. We did talk about this a little bit last week, but yeah, I mean, that's if you're going to make a list of really great interiors, you kind of have to, you know, you got to say 10, but really you're only picking 9 cars.
Yeah.
You know there's going to be a Rolls on it somewhere.
Well, and I think that the down-to-earth stuff is actually more interesting here. I think it's pretty impressive to see that the Chrysler 200 is on it now and the Jeep Cherokee. And I say that because for a long time, Chrysler interiors have been sort of out in the woods, you know, in terms of refinement, switchgear, and all that. Like, they had the options, but they never felt really terribly well screwed together or terribly fashionable. And I think Klaus Busse, who's their head of interior design, has done a really amazing job in pushing through, you know, unusual color palettes in everything from, you know, the leather to the metal effect trim and all of that stuff, so that you can actually order up a really unique looking vehicle. It's not just, do you want the gray or the black or the tan?
Yeah, and I love that. I love the special splashes of color in places, you know, that's really, you know, where the visual interest is. And it doesn't have to be premium to look premium that way. You know, when you see that attention has been paid to the way it looks, it makes it feel nicer than it may actually be.
Yeah, and I think that started with the Grand Cherokee and the Ram, and then it's really trickled down to some of their bread and butter stuff. So I'm really pleased to see that.
Yeah, and there's certainly, you know, it's funny, like they definitely know where to put the money into the pieces, you know, things you touch, the, you know, certain areas that you see, and then they know where they can go with a less expensive material and it's not going to offend anybody. And so that's the real fascinating part to look at this. So these are certainly, you know, I think this is a list, a good sort of rule of thumb, like these are the class of the field, I guess. If you're going to compare interiors, these are the cars to compare against. I love the fact that the GTI is on it.
Yeah, me too.
You know.
I think we all love to debate these lists, and that's part of the reason why they exist. I think Ward did a tremendous job on this list. The only thing I would change is the Equus.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be one. There always has to be one. All right. We have we've gotten to the point, I think, where we should hit some Q&A and then call it a night. But we did get an email question from a young driver, and he was very confused. He was actually asking what's wrong with him. I don't want to go through the whole email, but basically the gist was that he has a 94 Taurus, and apparently he loves it, which is crazy. But he's driven newer cars, and he's wondering what's wrong with him, because those cars sort of leave him cold. Let me pull up the email here. It's from Matthew, and he's saying, and he's got a 94 Taurus with the 3-liter Vulcan. He learned to drive on a 98 Explorer Sport, so old Ford family. Hated the Jeep Compass when he drove it. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
He's not confused then.
Right. There's nothing wrong with that. His biggest complaint was like the visibility. Yes. Yes. Put a bucket over your head and try to drive. That's about what it's like with the Compass. It's a Dodge Caravan. Didn't like that either. Steering feels non-existent. Gas pedal's very sensitive. Yes. Again. Yes. And he liked his 2008, his grandfather's 2008 Suzuki XL7.
It is a weird one.
Yeah.
That is a very strange one.
Yeah. And he test drove a 98 BMW 740 IL. Wants to go back and drive them willingly. Yeah, I'd drive the 740 IL pretty willingly. I don't know about the XL7. So I guess his point is what's wrong with him, because the cars that feel the most solid to him are a Taurus, 94 Taurus, a 94 Ranger, and a 98 BMW 740 are the best things he's driven so far. So is that wrong, given the fact that he's actually sampled newer cars, but it seems like the 90s domestic products and one very expensive German car from the 90s are just sort of do the thing for him?
Everybody's got their peccadillos, strange. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I think that if a Taurus feels solid to you, though, there's...
Well, I'm not so worried about the Taurus. I'm worried about the Danger Ranger. I mean, I've driven a lot of old, beaten-up Rangers in my time, and solid is never the word I'd use to describe them. Tetanus, that comes to mind. Rattly, I mean, it's a fun car to drive. Like, an old Ranger with a manual transmission that you can just rev the hell out of. It's a
that's all relative though. Rev right. The hell out of. That's
well,
the 2.3.
You have to four cylinder. No, you had power. To because it had no power whatsoever.
Well, it's efficient.
It was a lot of fun to drive.
It wasn't even terribly efficient because you had to rev the hell out.
No,
of it.
No, no, I'm saying it's efficient. It's got twice the noise of a Ferrari and half the power. I mean, at least he didn't say something like, oh, I really love the Crown Victoria, because that apparently is like the new hipster thing, and I hate that car.
Don't anger the Crown Victoria fans.
Oh, I hate the Panthers. They're just terrible pieces of junk.
Don't say that.
Oh. Are you a Panther fan?
I'm not a Panther fan, but I'm smart enough not to anger the Panther fan.
Oh, well, but see, you're not even going to get pulled over by one anymore. They're all like police interceptor Tauruses or Explorers. I got pulled over the other day, and it was an Explorer.
The police love the Panther, and because they can't drive it anymore, they're going to be more angry. That's my logic on it. So
I don't know. I mean, there's a police officer within my sort of family, and every year he enters one of their cruisers in a demolition derby, and I think that's the high point of his year, is just smashing one to bits.
Well, and whose year wouldn't that be a highlight of? That sounds like fun.
It's true.
I think the unknown here is what condition were all of these vehicles in? Because if you've got them all brand new box stock, then you're really comparing things fairly, but if you've got cars that were abused, that may have been wrecked, indifferently maintained, there's a wide variety of how one particular vehicle can feel. I've been in rock solid Rangers or rock solid Ford Ranger and complete piles from the same model year. I'm a former Ranger owner. I had a 99, and There's good ones and there's bad ones. And so I don't know. I mean, I think everybody's got things that they like, things that they're comfortable with, different, you know, maybe steering weights, brake, pedal actuation, the way they like to feel. So I don't think this person is crazy, Matt. Matt, you're not crazy.
No.
You probably need a larger sample size, but I think you're just being honest, and that's great.
No, I think what it really boils down to is, like you said, it's experience. You know, you need some time behind the wheel of a bunch of stuff. You know, I remember driving several of those DN5 Taurus and Sables, and, you know, especially with the 3.8, that was an awesome car in the 90s in terms of, like, it was big, it had plenty of power, it moved right along, it felt stable. Turns out it was kind of a rust-prone, transmission-eating, kind of non-long-lived car, but when they were new, they were pretty great. And so if it's in decent shape, it's not horrible. I mean, I learned to drive with a Fairmont-based car, so it's better than that. Drive some new stuff. You'll understand. Pay attention to how much the steering wheel jiggles in your hands when you go over bumps. That's the tell with older cars. So we also got another email too. Alan's currently looking at newer used TDIs. So he's torn between the Golf, the Jetta Sportwagon, and the Audi A3. Of course, we are huge fans of wagons, but we also seem to love the Golf cars, he says. Sportwagon is his least favorite looking, but it seems like it would be the most practical. Do we have any thoughts on that?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's good that the Sportwagon is his least favorite because he's probably never going to find one used. And they're extremely popular cars. And I am hearing this correctly. He said newer used cars.
So, newer as in not as old. But
right, so like a 2011 used. Or 2012. Or
that's exactly right. He's looking
okay, at 11, I just want to make 12. Sure. Yeah, I don't think you're going to find a lot of TDI Sportwagons laying about.
I think it's pretty hard to go wrong with either of those three. You know, they're all
the same car.
Yeah, for the most part, they're the same components. The A3 is going to maybe have a little bit nicer outfitting, but not so much with the older A3. You know, it's a different model than the new A3. I think, honestly, like, yeah, you may not like the looks of the Jetta Sportwagon as much. That's the best of those three. I think it's a little larger. It gives just as good fuel economy as the Golf. That would be my pick, and I think it actually looks better.
I think if you can find one of those to snap that up, but I would if that's not possible, I'd go with a Golf personally.
Yeah. All right, Chris, tiebreaker.
I would get the Jetta Sportwagon.
Didn't help.
Hey, you know what? Those things are huge inside. There's actual cargo room versus something like an A3 that really doesn't have a lot of it. And doesn't have the newer Audi interiors that are, you know, really stunning. I mean, granted, for the day, the A3 interior was very nice, but I would sooner take a Jetta Sportwagon, save a little money, and get more space.
Yeah, and I mean, a wagon with a manual and a diesel. That's holy.
That's the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
So they tell us. Brown.
We'll all get there. Yeah, it comes with a CD and the audio system of just like harps and an angelic chorus. So every time you turn it on, yeah. All right, one more email. Michael writes in, he's been blessed with the potential to buy a fun extra car. His budget's 10 to 15K, maybe 20 for the right car. Definitely used or pre-owned. He says he's of my proportion, which means he's short. That's flattering, I suppose. And we want something tossable. Previously owned a 99 NB Miata. Worries that his answer to everything is Miata, which is not a bad answer.
The answer isn't always Miata.
Yeah. He says his friend wants him to buy a Porsche Boxster like his. He's not a fan of the sound of a Boxster engine. Any suggestions in manual transmission?
He won't be a fan of the Porsche repair costs either, so...
Yeah.
No, but you can get, a used Boxster S for mid-teens, and they're actually pretty reliable. You don't want to have to replace the parts or the trim bits because they are expensive. But I think the instinct about the Miata is correct. He doesn't actually say that it has to be convertible, though. And if it's not, I might suggest something like a Scion FRS.
That's where I was going to go. Although, like, 20K, you think you can get into one of those? For, well, maybe you can get one now for
you
20.
You can get in one of those for close to 20K, yeah. I'd bet. The other one I'd recommend is wait a little while and see if you can pick up a Focus ST, or a Fiesta ST, I'm sorry.
Oh, Fiesta ST is a good time.
Fiesta ST is an awesome car. I love that thing.
I mean, for 10 to 15, even 20, you can also go for an S2000.
Yeah, that's a good point. S2000 is a good solid pick.
Very much like
when this is the fun extra car.
Yeah.
So the Fiesta is a big ball of fun, but if he's already got something that has a hatch or, you know, is practical for adults and kids and all of that, I would probably skew towards something a little bit purer, something like, you know, a Miata.
Yeah, and you know, because he has experience with Miata, that's going to be familiar territory. I mean, there's certainly some coupe options you could go with, but it seems like all the stuff that's going to be affordable in that range, like you could certainly find yourself like a 350Z and have a good time with that. But it's a different sort of thing, and it doesn't seem as sort of like scalpel-like with the handling, which I think is what you're going to get out of that car more so than just like brute speed. You know, I think that's more of if you're used to the Miata and if you want to use it for fun, like on a, you know, and make every drive fun, you want something that's really going to handle well and be responsive, not necessarily, you know, go cover quarter miles in 10 seconds. So I'll stick with the S2000. And there's two flavors too. You can get the early or the late. I like the late. I know Zach used to prefer the early. So there you go. All right, let's hit up the Q&A and then we'll get out of here. Where is the new Mazda Speed 3? That's the first question. I don't know. Are we going to see one soon?
I don't know that we'll see one soon. We haven't seen, as far as I know, any mules running around of that car, any prototypes. So I think it's still a little ways off. You know, of course, we could get a concept, and I think they will do one, but I wouldn't expect it to be in the next 12 months or so.
Yeah, probably, you know, maybe if they're smart, they'll wait for sales to lag a little bit and then they'll release the Mazda Speed 3, although that may not lift the sales enough anyway, given that it's kind of an enthusiast niche car. All right, so are there any cars to be shown at the New York Auto Show that you know little about that you're looking forward to actually seeing? You know, anything you will actually be surprised by, given that we have, you know, leaks and all kinds of stuff sort of happening before shows these days? Any actual surprises at New York?
Well, we haven't seen the Camry yet.
That is true.
So that's something right there. I don't know that there's anything that'll be massively surprising. And of course, you know, we're sitting on some embargoed stuff, so we've seen some of the things that we can't show you guys just yet, that I probably shouldn't even mention. I'm kind of interested in seeing the Land Rover Discovery concept. I think that should be kind of neat.
That transparent hood thing looks cool.
That looks crazy. Yeah. Super cool.
I thought that was pretty, you know, pretty interesting and another way to sort of, I'm expecting to see that sort of trickle down. You know, people are going to copy that. You're going to see aftermarket versions of that. And even other automakers are going to pick up on that. Because, you know, where do you go with the sort of off-road toys and technology? And apparently that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What is the best front-wheel drive V8 car of all time?
None of them.
Boy.
The answer is Toronado.
The answer is Toronado.
I was going to say Toronado, or if I'm going to be really weird, I'm going to say I've never driven one, but I've always been fascinated by the Lancia Tema with the Ferrari engine, the 832. That's a front-wheel drive car with the 3-liter Ferrari V8, and that was supposed to be a pretty cool car. So that's my obscure front-wheel drive V8 thing that I've always wanted to drive.
That is a very esoteric choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to go with that, though.
Okay, I mean Toronado, because they had like the 455.
Oh, yeah, 425. Super cool.
And they took that powertrain and made motorhomes out of it. I mean, you know.
I also think there's something, and this is really weird, but I've always been weirdly fascinated by the more like the later Pontiac V8s, like the Bonneville GXP and the Grand Prix GXP when they were putting the V8s in those. Because it strikes me as just such a strange package.
Yeah, those are like the they're not exact, they're not strict W bodies. I think they were like H bodies or something, but they're W based, right? Like the last of those cars. They had the V8s. There's one of those guys that at my office, he drives one. I heard him start it up one day, and it has aftermarket exhaust on it. And I was like, "What is that? Where's the muscle car?" And I see this silver Pontiac sedan. I was like, "Oh yeah, they put V8s in those."
Yeah, it's a very, very silly car, and it's probably going to be terrible to drive. I have no idea. I'm just guessing torque steer and all that stuff. But yeah, it's something that I've always really been interested in. I would love to get the chance to get behind the wheel of one.
I was always kind of fascinated by the Cadillac Seville STS and its final couple of generations, the K-body and the G-body. I don't actually know for a fact that they were that great to drive. I remember them garnering a bit of praise at the time, and I always liked their clean look. So I'm kind of fascinated by that as well, if we're looking at more recent things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the STS in all of its sort of iterations from when it – that was really when Cadillac's renaissance kind of started, right, in the 90s when they had the Northstar and the front-wheel drive cars. They had the STS. They had the Eldorado. They really started making a little bit more of a driver's car that could compete in its own Cadillac kind of way. And it's taken them from then till now to really be a credible player. Get rid of it before the Northstar torches. Apparently that's a big problem, which I didn't know about. I thought the Northstar was the neatest engine because that was, a new high-tech V8 that came out in the 90s. My formative years, I was all over it. I was like, yeah, that's awesome. Turns out it's like a non-rebuildable lump if it has a problem. So, all right. What are your thoughts on buying a bland car? Henry from Iowa. This is his sister's looking at purchasing a newer vehicle for around $12,000. She has her mind set on a 2012 Impala with the DI 3.6. He wants her in a Focus, a Civic, or a Dart, but she wants the Impala because they have more content for the money. I don't think he's ever going to talk her out of that car. the content for the money, that's a hard car to beat. I don't know.
By content, does she mean like just a lot of space?
Probably a lot of space, trunk, a decent engine. If it's got the 3.6, is that the LTZ of the 2012?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
So that's probably got the leather and all of the. I mean, that's not a terrible car for a nicely equipped rental.
It's not a terrible car for $12,000. It's not a sophisticated modern car, even though it's a newer vehicle. But if somebody is interested in a reliable, comfortable, quiet car for low money, I think that's not a terrible way to go. And I think Henry, you're probably trying to steer her into something that's completely different than what she actually wants. A Focus is a much smaller car, a Civic and a Dart. They're both, again, more sophisticated, more modern, smaller. But she may just want a couch that she wants to drive around with a lot of toys in it.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, I think given, you look at something like the smaller Focus or Civic sedans, too. If you're looking at hatches, it may be a different story. But you look at those sedans, and then you look at the Impala, which has an enormous trunk. That's a late 80s, early 90s design. So it's got a lot of space in it that some newer cars just don't have. It's hard to not recommend that car in terms of like the by the pound thing. It does okay. It's not really thrilling for sure, but it does its thing. And the last question we have, which we really can't answer, is what is the most reliable car on the market today? I
someone else's.
Yeah. a lease because it has maintenance covered. We did get a question, and maybe this is interesting because it's sort of more news out of Lincoln. They've just replaced Max Wolf with David Woodhouse, and they didn't necessarily replace him. They it looks like they let Max, who came over from Cadillac, focus on design, and they installed the guy to actually do some of the management stuff. Do you think that there's life at Lincoln because they're making these moves, or do you think that it's just sort of like, I'm not going to say the deck chairs on the Titanic, but I just did.
The answer to that is I have no idea. I actually was on Autoline After Hours last week with Chris Venson, who's the new head of Ford interior and exterior design for the Americas. And that came down the same day. And he didn't really want to talk about it. He said that he knew the reasons why that happened, but he wanted those people to talk to that. And I thought that was a really classy answer. He's not responsible for anything in the Lincoln portfolio. And obviously, I think the stuff on the Ford side, they've been making life really hard for Lincoln because they've designed such good looking Fords to base their vehicles off of. But I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Well, and, Lincoln has a tough spot to be in. But, they do have the MKZ, which, despite its early teething pains, has actually started to sell pretty decent numbers. And the MKC is coming. So that should give them a boost. They may actually manage to get off the ropes. The jury's still out. But, give Lincoln another 6 months and we'll check back in and make jokes at their expense probably.
Huh. Well, and let's remember that we just got done talking about Cadillac.
Right.
And 90s Cadillacs being the seeds of their renaissance. So let's not get ahead of Lincoln yet. I mean, you've got probably at least another 10 years before you can even start to make a judgment on whether they're being successful or not.
Yeah. So
provided Ford gives them that much time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the trick, right? Is Lincoln. And I've heard all these theories too. Like, Lincoln is just sort of on borrowed time. They're just running down the clock or whatever, I don't know. And I don't think any of us really know anyway. The people who do know are smart enough to not actually talk about it. Because they're probably contractually obligated to not do so. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. And, it's an interesting time in the car market. We've got some older brands sort of sunsetting. It's not like it's nothing that's happened, nothing that hasn't happened before. It's going to grow and shrink. We'll see some brands leave, some brands, will spring up new. So with that, my unbridled optimism, I think we have done another Autoblog podcast. So I want to say thank you to Chris Pockert. What was it? Autoblog.
Sovereign.
Sovereign. Right. I was going to say, supreme, but that's not right.
Chief Lackey.
Yeah. And Brandon Terkis. Thanks, guys, for coming out and talking the various subjects we went over here for Autoblog Podcast 376.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
We will catch you guys next week. The Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.